Welcome to Zen Mind, a podcast featuring talks from Zenki Dilo Roshi, the guiding teacher at the Boulder Zen Center here in Boulder, Colorado. We are excited to announce that Zenki Roshi's book, The Path of Aliveness, is now available in audiobook format. Whichever format you prefer your books, you can find it on Amazon. If you already own the book, rating it on Amazon is very helpful, and if you have a minute to leave a review, that's even better. This helps to spread the word and get the book into more people's hands. I have put a link to the book in the show notes. Today's talk was recorded as a public Dharma talk given on Saturday, January 14th. You are always welcome to join us live for our public Dharma talks, either in person or online. You can find the Dharma talk schedule as well as the Zoom link on our website. I've put that link in the show notes. Now here's Zenki Roshi.
Good morning. Have you heard this quote? I've mentioned it a number of times. It's quite famous. Suzuki Roshi said, "You're all, each of you, are Buddhas just as you are. And there's room for improvement." So, I wonder why this quote makes our heart smile or bends our mind a little bit out of shape. What's in there? Well, my first observation is that if someone says to you, "You are a Buddha," right, it's like, "Oh, really? I thought there was something wrong with me, or I thought, you know, I had to go a long way to become a Buddha, or, you know, there's, you know, I'm a flawed human being." So if you want to take this statement seriously, each of you is a Buddha, just as you are. You have to really seriously call into question a version of what I think a mental posture that most people carry, that there is something wrong with them, that there's something missing, that work needs to be done to find liberation. Okay, but then let's say you cross over and you say, okay, I'm a Buddha. Then Suzuki Roshi reminds you that there's room for improvement. So it's not that easy. This statement is complex. I think underneath it, it plays with the question of perfection. Am I imperfect and I need to do work to become a Buddha and then be a perfect human being? Or if you go along with, "You are already a Buddha," am I perfect? You know, so fine, nothing needs to be done. I don't have to pay attention. I'm okay, just the way I am. Then you get the message that there's room for improvement. And then you can take these two positions and basically decide that this is not a good way to think about it. It's like you can give up the black and white categories of perfect and imperfect. And maybe what can come out of that is some sense of, you know, a version of the Taoist wisdom of the path is the goal, and you might want to settle on, well, it's really about a path of perfecting. It's not helpful to view yourself as this lowly, flawed being that is indefinitely separated from the perfection of a Buddha. It also doesn't work to just ascribe to yourself some kind of perfection. So what you are is really an activity of perfecting. No need to call yourself bad, you know, right now in whatever situation you're in. And you can maintain an openness of looking responsibly at what's going on in your life and recognize what Suzuki Roshi calls this room for improvement. I think it's liberating. You know, it's liberating to make that shift. But then I think it's also possible to call into question the whole yardstick of perfection. Is it even necessary for us to evaluate ourselves this way? And maybe what's possible here is to throw this yardstick away. Don't use it. What you're left with is something like situational response ability. Your ability to respond to circumstances as they arise. There's this koan where a monk asks Yunmen, what is the teaching of a lifetime? Meaning, you know, what did the Buddha teach over the course of his lifetime? Or what is the essence of what he taught over the course of a lifetime? And Yunmen answers, an appropriate response. Okay, I want to take this even a step further. Because what I think is happening here is, like, underneath this question of, am I good enough? Am I perfect? Am I on a journey of perfecting? There is this idea of being a being. I'm this being, and you can identify this being that you are as this lowly, as the Buddhist vocabulary suggests to us, this lowly sentient being that isn't a Buddha, or you can identify this being that you are as this perfected Buddha. But one main thrust of Buddhist philosophy is to call into question this idea that we are a being. Now, one of the most common questions I get when people talk to me is to say to me that they can't make sense of this notion of non-self. And I think this is very understandable. I mean, I have this difficulty. I've had this difficulty. It's sort of like you look at yourself, you know, like, here I am. You know, what are you telling me, that I don't exist? It's crazy. It's something visceral like that. To be confronted with an idea of non-self is like, what's that supposed to be? This doesn't work. For a long time, I've asked myself, what this question of about the self is really about, like what's behind it as a kind of existential need. I think some of us aren't really asking the question, you know, we just live our lives or something. Well, behind it is clearly the question of who am I? And behind that question, I'm throwing this out. It's sort of a little bit of an experiment, you know, see if you agree. Maybe you disagree. That would be interesting. Behind this question of who am I is a need for some kind of existential security. I want to know who I am. If I know who I am, then I can live in accord with that. Does that make sense? Can you recognize that in yourself? If you don't know who you are, it's sort of like, geez, then what? Like, I'm just like thrown around by circumstances. Like, where am I anchored? What is, you know? So I think in that form, whether you ask the question in an articulated way or maybe it's rather subconscious, I think in that way, the question haunts us in one way or another. If you suffer a serious loss, like your spouse dies, or you lose your job, or you go through a crisis in which you realize, you know, a situation forced you, I don't know if that's true for, but seemingly forced you to go against your values, or, you know, something like that. You can experience a kind of identity crisis, you know, who am I now? How do I want to continue? Does this make sense, the way I have set up my life? Have I lived along the wrong set of values? Okay, and I find this, and so maybe the question, who am I, the question about the self, is culturally usually formulated as a question of identity. Now, identity is a funny thing. It's a funny concept, funny word even. It implies that there are aspects of ourselves that are self-same over time and that they define us. When you ask who am I, or you ask about your identity, if I do that, if I just go through the exercises, like, what are you going to say? And what I notice right away is like my mind goes to the categories that my culture supplies for answering the question. I don't know. I mean, Bodhidharma, when asked, who are you, answered, I don't know. right? But if you're not that daring to say that to the emperor, as Bodhidharma did when he said, who are you? And you say to the emperor, I don't know, you know, it's like, maybe you just go to the city of Boulder, you go to the office and they, who are you? And you say, I don't know. Like, what are they going to think of you? Do they think you're a spiritual master, or they just dismiss you and say, like, well, once you can say, when you can identify yourself, come back. So, of course, it's a stylized story when Bodhidharma meets the emperor and asks, and the emperor asks, who is the representative of Chinese culture, right? The epitome of Chinese culture asks, who are you? And Bodhidharma is daring enough to not answer the question. Okay, so if I let my culture ask the question, who are you? Well, what are the categories that come? You know, it's like nationality, you know, I'm German, but now I'm also American, so already gets kind of fuzzy, right? Like, am I more German where I grew up and was raised, or am I more American now because that's where I live and I got an American passport? What am I going to say? Like, for some of you, it's maybe easy because you don't have two passports, but you can feel the weirdness. It's like, I just got born here. Huh? So what? This is part of my identity? I'm American? Or your profession, you know? You know, there's some activities that I'm engaged in administrative activities in maintaining this nonprofit organization we call the Boulder Zen Center. So maybe, you know, I could be called a director, you know. So then that becomes part of my identity. I'm the director of a nonprofit. Your skin color, right? Like, I'm white. It's really disturbing kind of for me as a, having grown up in Germany and living in America, one thing I find kind of disturbing, the how ubiquitous the word race is. Now, Germany with its difficult history, having descended into a whole period of racism, it's sort of like the way I was brought up, that race is really a category that is a construct that's not useful. It's like, well, it should be avoided, you know? It's like, we don't distinguish people according to race, but, you know, now I live in America, it happens all the time. It happens by racists and it happens by anti-racists, and the category is alive. It's like, let's distinguish people according to race. I guess for those who are really involved with that category, it is a question of existential security. You know, are you on top of the societal differentiations that are made according to this kind of category, or are you at the bottom? Do you have to defend your advantages in the society, or do you have to fight for rights that are being denied to you? But when I notice this dynamic, it's like the kind of existential or spiritual quest that I have is not answered by these kinds of categories: nationality, profession, race, sex, gender, you know. Our cultural discourse is full of it right now. I don't know if you find it satisfying wherever you find yourself in that discourse. I don't find it particularly satisfying. I understand that the culture organizes itself through these categories, but I don't feel I am met by them in my existential presence. I'm thinking Bodhidharma speaking to the emperors refused to be inside of these categories of identity. When asked, who are you? He said, I don't know. Now, because, and I'm just speaking sort of in examples, right? And you can extend the examples. If you go to the city of Boulder, there's an expectation that you know your identity and that when you fill out a form, you are willing to make little check marks. And we could say, maybe we can't avoid participating in that cultural dynamic. It has a function to be identified as something, to be grouped with other people who fall into that same category. So as practitioners, if we recognize our need to clarify our existential situation, but at the same time maybe recognize the dissatisfying quality of allowing ourselves to be moved into these identity categories, again, they have a function. They are used to gain access to certain societal arenas or move out of certain arenas into others. Well, what's the alternative? You know, well, how can we really respond to our existential and spiritual quest here? So one idea that was suggested to me by my teacher was to change the question from who am I to what am I? Okay, but what does that really mean? What does this really mean? It allows you to change what you observe about yourself. Now, I gave this list, your nationality and profession and race and sex and gender, and you can extend that to personality traits, you know, then you get adjectives. With the famous personality traits, you know, from Western social psychology. The acronym is OCEAN: open, conscientious, extroverted, what is it, agreeable, and neurotic. You know, where do you find yourself on the spectrum of these categories? So, so you can observe yourself in these kinds of categories, or you can begin to observe yourself in really different ways. So one approach that I made in my book, The Path of Aliveness, is I suggested these four existential, I call them now, I'm now, for this talk, I'm calling them existential. Well, we'll see where that goes, but existential ingredients. So they are attention, sensation, intention and cognition. All right, so make this shift. If you ask, who am I? Or now you shift it to, what am I? And you ask yourself what you are with regard to attention, not with regard to nationality or with regard to, I don't know, gender or the color of your skin. No, you ask yourself with regard to attention. You see how that different that is? This is it's almost trivial to talk about it that way, but what a massive shift if you get interested not how you fit into cultural categories and whether people accept you in them or not. You leave that behind. The emperor asks you and you say, I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in that right now. I'm going to ask about attention. How does it move? From moment to moment. What is it drawn to? What habits is it embedded in? When is it focused and when is it wide? How does that make a difference? As I often say, where your attention goes, your life goes. At this time, at this very moment, our attention is absorbed in this Dharma talk situation. And this is where our life is going right now. And if you zoom away from this talk, then your life goes somewhere else. If your attention repeatedly goes to something, it makes a kind of habit groove. If you don't like your habit groove, you need to see if you can get your attention out of that rut. When you start to look at your life as a function of attention, you're not asking, you know, am I a good person or am I a bad person? You're asking about what habit structures is my attention embedded in. It's not unrelated because, you know, certain cultural ruts are absorbing our attention. But it's a different way of asking about the situation. Okay, the second ingredient is sensation. Sensation, the way I use the word, it's maybe, you know, it's not maybe ideal, but basically I say sensation is everything that arises through the senses. It's sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And it's also, importantly, it is what we feel in the region of our physical body. What we feel on the inside of our being. And it is also what arises through the mind, images, thoughts, and so forth. In the Buddhist system, mind is included in the realm of the senses. What am I? The question, what am I? I am a movement of attention. And I'm also a movement of sensation. And when attention merges with sensation, it's like there's an arising of an experience. And it's important to notice it's selective. It's selective what arises from moment to moment, from the whole wide range of sensations that are available. Attention selects certain sensations to come to the forefront of attentional consciousness. This is what I am at this moment. And then there is the ingredient of intention, and the way I define intention is that it's that which gives direction to attention. Where you keep going with your attention is determined by your intention. I have the intention to complete this talk, right? So my attention stays involved with giving this talk until it comes to a certain kind of completion. This is also what I am. And I think our intentions, it's such a fascinating, I don't know, I'm not pretending I'm plumbing the depth of what I'm saying here. Sometimes I feel, wow, I'm not in control of intention. I'm evolutionarily embedded in the intention to survive. If I'm hungry, you know, I look for food. That becomes my intention. If you know what it's like to be hangry, you know, you can ignore it for a while, but at some point it just takes over. You just get angry basically with anything you have to do besides eating food. Maybe you say like, wow, what's wrong with me? Why am I so irritable? But I would say the reason I'm irritable in this way is because this is a complicated way of saying it, I'm evolutionarily embedded in the intention to survive. So something just takes over and makes me go eat something. But I'm evolutionarily embedded in the intentions of, you know, sex and procreation too. I sometimes think, you know, we expect people to be in control of their sexual activities, but maybe they're not, you know, maybe we're not in control. Just the way we're not really in control of our intention to survive. You could have the idea that you're a really kind person to everyone around you, but when it comes to a survival situation, you might look out for yourself. Be somewhat surprised about how strong that intention is. Of course, it's complex because we know that we're in many ways we're stronger as a group, so we also do look out for others in order to survive. Not black and white, but what I'm saying is there are certain, it's a little bit, there's a depth there, a dark depth that we can't fully see into of like where our intentions are rooted. And then the fourth ingredient I call cognition. So when you bring categories, concepts, conceptual categories to attentional consciousness that we just described, or that I just described as attention selecting from the vast field of what arises through the senses, when you bring concepts to that, then you are in the realm of cognition. So yeah, the weird thing about cognition is that it can sort of replace our direct engagement with attention and sensation, because now the concepts are allowing us to pull together a whole host of experiences that reaches from the past into the future as one thing. This is what we're trying to do when we ask, who am I? We're trying to employ a concept that pulls us together from the past into the present, from the past to the present and into the future. I am that thing. I am that person, past, present, and future. And so when you employ concepts like that, it disregards change. One of the main directions of Buddhist practice, which is very emphasized in Zen, is to disentangle attention from cognition. Free your attention from being bound up in these categories. There's a wonderful introduction to a koan. It's koan number 12 in the Book of Serenity, and it goes, "Writers plow with the pen. Orators plow with the tongue. We patch-robed monks lazily watch a white ox on an open field, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. How to pass the days." Okay, again, writers plow with the pen. Orators plow with the tongue. Okay, so here are the folks that employ cognition. They try to get to the truth of whatever, you know, whatever truth we want to imagine. They try to get to it with the pen and the tongue, with the tool functions that employ conceptuality. But we patch-robed monks, I wonder if you see yourself as part of that group. I think you should. Or I'm inviting you to see yourself as part of that group. Even if you don't have a patched robe, which means a robe that is sewn together from different pieces of cloth that you found by the side of the road to make yourself a dress. What is a monk? A monk is someone, in Zen, a monk is a home leaver. Bodhidharma is a monk because he dares to tell the emperor that he doesn't know who he is. He is not absorbed, he refuses to be absorbed by the culture. It's like, can you imagine to live within the culture and its categories and its demands for identity, while at the same time having a portion of what you are exist outside of the culture. If you imagine that as a way to be free from identity demands, then you are in that group of the patched robe monks. We patched robe monks lazily watch a white ox on an open field. So, lazily, you know, without any culturally identifiable purpose. You know, sometimes in Zen, you get this talk, is like, what is meditation good for? It's good for nothing. Of course, then you can ask, well, then why should I do it? Well, here you have the same kind of attitude, like lazily, with no identifiable purpose that's good for anything in the realm of the culture, you watch. And look, the way I read the white ox on an open field, I read it as what I call focus and field. You watch how attention functions. It moves in a wide field. It's like you can discover by lazily watching, this is meditation, you know, lazily watching attention, you can discover that you are this attentional presence and call awareness. And from moment to moment, it solidifies into an object, you know, a sensation that gets picked up by your attentional focus. So from moment to moment, you're watching something, maybe a white ox, in an open field, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. What's that? That's all the concepts that are floating around that you could, you know, apply here. It's auspicious because that gets you somewhere in the culture if you make sense of everything, if you explain stuff, if you understand, that gets you somewhere. That's well, right now I'm interpreting auspicious that way. But, you know, that kind of stuff becomes rootless when it's not tied back to the immediacy of our experience of attention interacting with sensation from moment to moment. Okay. This is a practice, right? It's poetically expressed here as lazily watching a white ox on an open field. And over time, it answers, not conceptually, but it answers a question about what am I? I'm this attentional presence. Through the practice of bringing attention to attention, you discover this presence that is sort of the, hesitant to say it that way, it's the source or ground of your existence. And it's free. it can be daring to say, I don't know. Or, who are you? I don't know. So if you're intrigued by Suzuki Roshi's statement, like, each of you is a Buddha just as you are. One way you can make sense of that is that you are already these existential ingredients. You already are attention and sensation and intention and cognition. Your existence comes endowed with these functions. You could say practice is a way to notice, become familiar with them, with these functions, with what you are, and allow yourself to remix them, organize them differently. Don't fall into the demands of the culture in how to use these functions. But then, so, you know, our quest for a Buddha identity actually morphs into becoming a Buddha activity. A skillful way to employ these functions that we are. So that reconnects with this idea of being able to respond, your response ability. You could say that's where we fulfill our responsibility, by finding our response ability from a familiarity with these functions, existential functions of attention, sensation, intention, cognition. This list isn't like, you don't have to consider it complete. You can see if there are other functions that you consider essential. It's about the approach to ask yourself about your existence in a different way. Then, in this introduction to the koan, lazily watching a white oxen on an open field, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass, and then how to pass the days. Now that you know yourself this way, now that you've made a commitment to exploring yourself this way, how to pass the days? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to use your freedom? What's worth doing? Which intentions do you want to embrace in this difficult mix of intentions that are rooted also in our biology? You know, what are the intentions that you're going to embrace and make a vow out of to give direction to the, from moment to moment, of where your attention flows? Thank you very much.